The right to be called by your own name today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. In some parts of Afghanistan, women are not called by their own names in public. Instead, a woman might be referred to as her father's daughter or a sister. Now there's a campaign to stop that and give all Afghan women the recognition they deserve.
We carry children in our bodies and we take care of them, and we are held responsible if our children, quote unquote, fail, but we never get credit for being their mothers.
And later, the theory behind soccer's financial fair play rule.
It is supposed to keep the richest owners of soccer teams from spending their way to titles year in and year out without giving the competition a fair chance.
But it doesn't always work. Just ask Neymar, the $250 million man. The stories today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Good to have you with us on this Wednesday, a day that has us wondering what a $250 million man does.
Valencia, it's Neymar! It's 1-0!
In Neymar's case, it's getting a ball into the net. Now, if Neymar were a woman here, he'd be getting, what's 80% of $250 million? Yeah, not fair by a long shot. Anyway, we'll come back to Neymar and his $250 million deal later on the show. We want to start with a focus on women and how, in many parts of the world, they can be invisible. Let me give you an example. Assume for a moment I'm in Afghanistan. My wife, it turns out, would not be publicly referred to by her own name.
Yeah, so she would be probably known as Marco's wife.
Because according to Afghan tradition, it's taboo to use a woman's real name in public. But now there's a campaign to challenge this under the hashtag, Where is My Name? We reached Nurjahan Akbar in Washington. She's the founder of Free Women Writers. It's a forum for Afghan women to express themselves through stories and poetry. She tells me there are many words for women that deny them a name.
You know, often in public, there's this term that I personally have a big problem with. It literally translates into black-headed. And what it means is that you are somebody to be pitied, because black is often associated with loss and grief and sadness. That's one word that people use. Another word that they use is sister, but not necessarily the word sister. It translates into milk sharer, which means we shared a mother. So these words are all ways for the communities to basically avoid saying women's names. Another really common tradition is to refer to women by the names of their sons or their husbands. So I could be called the daughter of my father, or I could be called the wife of my husband, or I could be called the mother of my son.
What is it about using a woman's name in public that makes it so taboo?
You know, I think sociologically it goes back to this culture of using women's bodies for men to shame each other, using women's bodies as battlefields. So often when men get into fights in public, instead of disrespecting each other, they make threats, often sexual threats, against the woman in the other person's family. So they would say, I will do this to your mother, or I'll do this to your sister. And the threat becomes so much more real and so much more offensive if you use the real name of the woman. So I think that's a big part of it, is this idea that if people know my sister or my mother's name or my wife's name, they will use it to disrespect me. Her body, her name, her identity will be used against me. Another part of it is that traditionally women are seen as men's property in Afghanistan. You know, for as long as you live in your mother's and your father's house, you are... Afghan women are actually told, including myself, you know, you are a gift to your family and you belong to your father. Your name belongs to your father until you get married, and then you are a gift to your husband.
So you've experienced this yourself?
Absolutely. I mean, I don't know any Afghan woman who hasn't. And many say that it's because we respect women. Their name is too valuable to be said in public. But I feel like this is just a glorified, benevolent form of sexism.
Tell us more about this campaign. Has it really started a conversation online, do you think?
Not just offline. So I was in Kabul when this campaign started, and I run a platform for Afghan women, and our Farsi, our Persian pages have about 60,000 readers. And within the launch of the hashtag, within that week, we got 15 pieces of writing from women around the country. It seemed like a lot of women had thought about this, but didn't necessarily have the language to speak about it. And, you know, what's fantastic about this campaign is that it's completely grassroots. You know, it wasn't a foreign NGO. It wasn't a women's rights organization. It was just a group of women in Herat, in Afghanistan, who, you know, took an initiative and decided to challenge this.
Is it completely grassroots? Because if you don't have a computer, how would you participate?
Yes. So it is grassroots in the sense that ordinary women started it. But I do think, you know, it does prevent some communities who don't have access to the internet from being part of the conversation. However, when I was in Kabul, you know, this hashtag was discussed on radio, it was discussed on TV, it was discussed in newspapers. So it really went beyond an online campaign. And, you know, just like I'm interviewing with you, I had interviews in Afghanistan about this with Afghan radio stations.
Just as an illustration of how big an issue this is in Afghanistan, just remind us what happened when current President Ashraf Ghani introduced his wife by name when he became president in 2014. That was a big deal.
Yeah, absolutely. So when President Ashraf Ghani mentioned his wife in public and pointed at her, you know, on national TV with thousands of listeners in the room, it was sort of a moment of shock, and it caused an online conversation and then caused an offline conversation, a dinner table conversation, which was really fantastic. But I just want to point out that even before this, Afghan leaders had used the names of their spouses publicly. For example, King Amanullah Khan, his wife was, even though she was a woman and she was the queen, she had actual power in the government. She was viewed as a monarch, and her name was well known. So in some ways, I sometimes feel like Afghanistan is going back to gain some of the freedoms that we had even back in the 1920s.
Noorjahan Akbar, founder of Free Women Writers. She's been telling us about the hashtag Where Is My Name that was started by Afghan women. Noorjahan, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you. Have a great day.
There are other ways that women find themselves invisible, as with this next story about gay life in Senegal. Homosexual acts are illegal in Senegal, and gay people are often targets of violence there, like other parts of West Africa. Still, there are a few LGBT groups operating openly in Senegal. They're almost exclusively organized by and for men. But now lesbians in Senegal are starting to fight for recognition, too. Sarah Elzis has our story from Dakar.
It's not easy to track down gay women in Senegal. When I finally get a hold of the president of the country's only lesbian rights group, she invites me to a workshop the next day, but she doesn't tell me where it is. I have to take a taxi driven by someone she trusts.
Ça va?
Ça va bien, merci.
He picks me up in Dakar. We drive 2 hours south to a town on the ocean. He drops me off at a small hotel. It's not exactly a secret location, but it's remote enough for a group of women to spend a couple of days together without attracting too much attention. We arrive just after lunch. Some women are relaxing, playing pool. There are no openly gay clubs in Dakar, and few, if any, places for gay people to spend time together where they feel safe, which is why this kind of gathering, as simple as it seems, is so important to someone like Nash. She's watching the pool game. She's wearing a white button-down shirt and jeans.
On fait ce qu'on veut. Ici, on est libre. On s'épanouit.
We do what we want here, she says. We're free. We'd like this to happen every weekend. Nash isn't her real name. Like all the gay women and men I spoke to in Senegal, she asked to remain anonymous for her protection. Homosexual acts are illegal here, punishable by up to 5 years in prison, and attitudes about gay people are overwhelmingly negative. So Nash is cautious. She studied law, but hasn't found a job, so she can't afford to live on her own. She lives at home with her family, which means she has to find somewhere more private in order to see her girlfriend.
On est obligé de programmer ça. 2 mois, 3 mois, pour trouver un endroit.
We have to plan 2 or 3 months in advance to find a place, she says. Sometimes a friend lends you a room for the day, but it's not 100% secure. This fear of being discovered and kicked out of the house is something nearly every gay person I met in Senegal talked about, both women and men.
Come on. Come on, ça va?
Jamil Bangoura is the founder of Senegal's oldest LGBT organization called Prudence. On a recent afternoon, a young man came to his office for help after his family threw him out. Bangoura asked him what happened. The young man says he brought another man to his bedroom. His brother surprised them and alerted the whole family. That's when my father told me to leave, he says. Now he's sleeping on the street.
Je dors dans la rue.
On va réfléchir ensemble, on va voir si
Bangura says he'll help find him a safe place to stay. He often does this, even though his group is ostensibly focused on helping gay men get tested and treated for HIV. Prudence was founded in response to the AIDS crisis in Senegal in the early 2000s. Public health groups realized that while they were making headway in lowering infection rates, the rate among gay men remained high. It's still about 20%. So they reached out to people like Bangura.
At the time, they needed gay people. They were looking for a snowball effect.
He got involved and recruited others, and he founded Prudence, the country's first gay advocacy group. Ndeye Kebe, who's the head of Sourire de Femme, the group that hosted the gathering I went to, says this was a success for men.
They got gays to come out of hiding and got them to organize, and they worked with them. But gay women don't have as much risk in terms of HIV, so they aren't taken care of.
And not only are they ignored by LGBT groups focused on HIV, gay women are also left out of Senegal's women's movement.
Some women's groups known for fighting for rights, they don't want to have anything to do with gay women. They don't want them in their federations or networks.
This is frustrating, she says, because lesbians are fighting for the same rights as heterosexual women.
You can't be lesbian without being a feminist. We're not just fighting for lesbian rights, we're fighting for women's rights.
Though not all lesbian women see it in these terms. Dija rents a room in Dakar. She's 26 years old and managed to save up enough money to move to the capital a few months ago. She came because there are more work opportunities here. She also hopes to meet other lesbians.
I'd like to meet a girl who loves me, someone I'm comfortable with, and little by little convince my family that's how I am. You have to accept me how I am.
Her family, she says, puts a lot of pressure on her to be like everyone else.
When are you going to get married? You're not married? It's always the same questions. In my family, you have to have a husband. That's it. For women, it's the home, housework, kids, husband. That's it.
In Dakar, Dija's connected with an LGBT group. It's mostly men. When she hangs out with them, she's often the only woman there, and she ends up in the kitchen preparing lunch.
I'm used to cooking for my family, so it doesn't bother me to do it here.
Ndeye Kebe with Sourire de Femme says it's hard to break out of traditional ways of thinking, even among the few gay organizations here.
Maybe it's our culture, our education that's put this in our heads, which makes it so we're reproducing the patriarchal system.
Moving beyond this won't happen overnight. Like gay rights in Senegal, it's a slow, step-by-step process and requires a big shift in perspective for everyone.
I think that culture is just culture. We need to try to take what's best in the culture and use it. And what there is to perfect, let's try to perfect it.
For the world, Sarah Elzis in Dakar, Senegal.
Sarah's story was supported by a grant from the International Reporting Project. By the way, our Across Women's Lives team is on the ground in South Africa right now, and they're having frank conversations with young women there about HIV. This teenager recalls the day she found out she was HIV positive.
I wanted to hold myself and not to cry, but, you know, I didn't make it. I cried, and then I cried enough, and I had to accept myself before I expect somebody else to accept me. That's who I am.
That story on Friday. There's also more from the team on Saturday. We're hosting a Facebook Live with MTV in Johannesburg, taking your questions about contraception, teen pregnancy, and the risks of unprotected sex. That's on the Across Women's Lives Facebook page on Saturday at 10 a.m. Eastern. You're with the world.
I like words.
A podcast.
Elegant, flowery words.
About language.
Tonsorial.
The world in words.
Grapple, jostle.
The world in words.
Crunchy, crackly words.
Get it on Apple Podcasts.
Or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Let me introduce you to Matthew Tueller. He's a career diplomat who knows the Middle East. He's held posts in Egypt, Iraq, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates. And in 2014, he took over as U.S. ambassador to Yemen. And he's watched that country slip into a civil war that's now what the UN calls the worst humanitarian crisis on earth. Matthew Tueller, thanks very much for being here. Ambassador, you're more than 7,000 miles from home. The country you're ambassador to is at war, really with itself, and there's not much focus in Washington on the problems you deal with every day. What is it like just being the ambassador to Yemen right now?
Well, thank you, Marco. It's a pleasure to talk with you. There are obviously a lot of hardships associated with an assignment to a place like Yemen, and those are compounded because after almost 1 year in the country, we had to close down our embassy and move the core embassy staff away, primarily in Saudi Arabia, where we continue to try to engage. I don't feel like I lack support from Washington, certainly. I think that during the time that I have continued to engage in this, Yemen has been a primary concern for a lot of the policymakers, both in the State Department, in the Department of Defense, the White House. And that's because to the United States, Yemen is an important country.
Now, you say you've got support in Washington, even as the State Department suffers from many vacancies the Trump administration hasn't filled?
Well, transitions, of course, are always periods of time where it's difficult, and there are indeed a number of positions in the State Department that aren't filled. But I deal on a daily basis with colleagues in Washington, both in the State Department, in DOD, who are very supportive, off whom I can bounce ideas. And that has continued into this new administration. I would say that it's interesting that Secretary Tillerson actually has some experience in Yemen, lived in the country as a private sector employee of ExxonMobil. And so I sense that he has quite a bit of interest and, of course, brings some knowledge from time on the ground and perspective as a private sector energy company employee who had to deal with what has always been a difficult place for both government and private sector officials to operate.
And yet there seems to be a lot of distance between Tillerson and the rest of the White House. Are you concerned that Yemen is suffering from just a lack of attention to world affairs right now in Washington?
Well, I'd certainly hate to think that we are somehow not doing all we can to try to address what really is, as you said, a humanitarian crisis, but also a conflict that has the potential to grow. And I hope even now as we speak that some of the efforts that we as the U.S. are trying to engage in will put us in a leadership role, not only of trying to bring Yemenis into a place where they can start to work to resolve their differences, but also to bring some of the regional actors who obviously have interest at stake in Yemen also into a position where we can move towards what just about everybody that I speak with believes, that there is no prospect of one side or the other coming out of this with a military victory. Really, this can only end if the parties agree to a series of sequence compromises to lead back to a peaceful transition that will get Yemen back where governance is restored in the country.
Ambassador, I would imagine Yemen is a Foreign Service hardship post these days.
Yes, it's always been a hardship post, and yet myself and I believe all of my colleagues who have served before me really have a great deal of admiration for the Yemeni people. And I think it's true of many people who have lived in Yemen, are enchanted by the place. Anything that I do here, I don't do alone. I've got a committed team. We have had to, of course, downsize considerably from what is a full embassy that we had in Sana'a. So we have really what we like to think of as a small, committed, expeditionary team, the core of that in Jeddah, but we have elements also that operate here in Amman, in Abu Dhabi, in Djibouti, so that we can cover all of the various economic, security and political issues at stake for the U.S. And what we largely are doing is engaging with all of the elements of Yemeni society that are in exile or those who are in the country, and we devise unique and creative means in order to stay in contact with allies and contacts and even some of our former employees inside Yemen. And then, of course, we also engage regularly with the governments of the Arab coalition.
You know, even for someone like myself, I read Yemen news pretty regularly. This is a complicated mess. When someone asks you to explain what's going on in Yemen, maybe an acquaintance who doesn't follow the Middle East, what do you say? And these days, do you cast it as a humanitarian thing or a battle that continues to grow?
Well, I sometimes tell people if they have a passing familiarity with the Middle East that a lot of the factors that cause instability in the Middle East exist in sort of orders of magnitude in Yemen. Poverty, corruption, weak institutions of governance, the sectarian issues. All of these factors, including the tribal nature of Yemeni society, means that there is very little grounds that has developed for trust amongst all of the people, who therefore fear that if one side gains power, they will use that power to exclude everybody else and to reward their own group. This is a civil war. This is Yemenis fighting against Yemenis. And until we have some mechanism to get the Yemenis to step back and make political compromises, the conflict is going to go on.
Why is it beyond the ability of the U.S. to insist on a ceasefire?
Well, we simply don't have leverage over the groups that are actually fighting on the ground.
Why don't we? We've spent $110 billion on weapons in this war.
Well, you seem to be referring to the involvement of the Saudi-led coalition in the conflict, and we certainly are a major partner in Saudi Arabia in security. We provide weapons. But the conflict in Yemen is not a conflict between Saudis and Yemenis. It is a conflict between Yemenis. The Saudis have intervened on behalf of the Yemenis, who feel that they have a weaker military position and who want to try to resume the peaceful transition. But we don't have the ability to tell those Yemenis who are involved in what for them is an existential conflict against perennial enemies. And even, say, for hypothetically, if the Saudi coalition were to say, we are going to pause or cease or end our involvement in the conflict, that would not end the conflict. In fact, arguably, it would lead to advances on the part of Houthis that would go deeper now into areas that currently are under control of the legitimate government, and simply would cause more humanitarian suffering, and in the long term would leave Yemen in a very, very vulnerable position.
My conversation with Ambassador Tueller went on from here, but I wanted to get a reality check on one of his key points, this one.
Well, we simply don't have leverage over the groups that are actually fighting on the ground.
Now, not everyone agrees that the U.S. has no leverage in Yemen. We reached out to a Yemen expert at the American Enterprise Institute in Washington. Catherine Zimmerman believes the U.S. can and should do more to move Yemen's warring sides toward peace.
The United States is choosing not to have influence over the warring parties in Yemen. We are constraining ourselves in terms of who we're talking to and how we are engaging with them. Our Yemeni embassy, to start with, is understaffed for the task ahead of it. So we don't have enough people to meet with Yemenis. But beyond that, all of our staff is in Saudi Arabia and doesn't travel around the region to meet with Yemenis that have moved outside of the country. We should be engaging with all parties and understanding what they want.
So the Yemen war and the U.S. role there remain a work in progress.
What would the news sound like if media were diverse?
Things get racialized here. Muslim is this weird racial thing here, and I don't think our parents were prepared for that.
I'm Rupa Shenoy, host of the podcast Otherhood. Listen to What You're Missing on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. A young man in India investigates his great uncle's time in the army and makes a big discovery.
All of the young men of my family, of that generation, who had gone off to serve in the colonial Indian Army and had fought in World War II in different parts of the world. And this was quite a revelation to me.
The unseen Dunkirk, still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Dunkirk has been the surprise hit of the summer.
There are 400,000 men on this beach.
The story of how the beaten British army escaped the Germans at the beginning of World War II on a beach in Dunkirk in northern France. Not everyone likes war movies. I like Dunkirk, but my family was split. I'm even kind of surprised it's doing so well at the box office here. There's not a single American in it. America wouldn't even be fighting in Northwest Europe during the war for another 4 years. But the movie has caused a minor stink in Britain and India, since none of the Indian soldiers in the British colonial army are on screen.
That's just ridiculous.
This is Chris Wolfe, the world's history guy.
Well, I must apologize. That was my initial reaction. But it turns out I was completely wrong. I just had never heard of such a thing. I'm a pretty keen historian. I'm a Brit, so we know the story of Dunkirk very well. And it made no military sense for there to be any Indian soldiers in Dunkirk. But it turns out I was wrong. They were there, and these guys were unfortunately literally whitewashed out of history.
Yeah, so we're talking about the Royal India Army Service Corps. War. What were they doing in Dunkirk and why were they there?
Well, when the British Army went to France at the beginning of the war, it was a totally mechanized force, revolutionary for its time. But of course, as soon as they get into the field, they realize they're having a problem moving supplies and equipment over rough ground. So the call goes out to the Empire for animal service companies. So the Empire at this time included India and what's now Pakistan, and a force was assembled, labeled K6, to fill this vital role of mule and horse transport.
So were these not real combat troops, or were they doing some fighting?
Well, they were, like all soldiers, trained to fight as needed, but that wasn't their primary role. However, even the chaos of the retreat to Dunkirk, there was fighting, and it should be noted that these troops were recognized for keeping order and discipline amidst all the chaos that you see in the movie. Mm. Some were killed, and some were decorated for bravery. So,
how many troops are we talking about from India?
It's difficult to nail down exactly. There were four companies plus headquarters detachments. So there could be anything from 400 up to 1,000 troops. One thing for sure, they were all Muslim. The Brits wanted to simplify their logistical and spiritual support needs. So they thought if they bring troops from just one religion, they're only going to have to look after one set of food issues, halal meat, obviously, for the Muslim soldiers.
So as we see at the end of Dunkirk, and I don't think there's a spoiler here, the troops are rescued and they're taken back to England. What about the Indian troops? What happened to them?
Well, most were evacuated to the UK, but one company, which was attached to a British division that was on the Maginot Line deep in eastern France, was captured along with the rest of that division. I was able to document at least one officer from that company, Jemadar Jahandad, later escaped disguised as a French colonial soldier. So when they were paroled, he snuck off to Marseille and gone aboard a ship to the British colony of Gibraltar. This was a man with 27 years of service in the British Indian Army. But yes, most of the rest stayed in the UK until 1944, when they were sent back to India to join the Burma campaign fighting the Japanese.
So why is this story of the Royal Indian Army Service Corps so unknown? I mean, presumably you didn't know about it. You didn't learn about it in school.
No, I think the Dunkirk spirit was so much more than just the movie portrays. It was the spirit of resistance, and the Dunkirk symbolized it, that we weren't going to give up just because all of our allies had been crushed and beaten, that Britain was going to carry on the war by itself. And I think the key there is that notion that we're going to carry on our own. So I think having all these imperial contributions kind of complicates that narrative. So you can see how literally they would have been written out and the army in Dunkirk portrayed as purely British.
That's the world's history guy, Chris Wolfe. Raghu Karnad is an editor at The Wire India. He's also the author of Farthest Field, an Indian story of the Second World War. So when you were taught history, Raghu, what did you learn about India's role in World War II?
Nothing at all, Marco.
Really?
You know, when I was a teenager, I was a big World War II buff. And later in my life, I've been a journalist, and I fancy that I knew quite a lot about India's modern history. And yet somehow until a couple of years ago, it never occurred to me to think about how the two overlapped. And it was only this family connection that I explored in my book that revealed to me that India ever had a part in the Second World War.
Tell me about your family connection.
Well, it began with the photographs of three young men that I'd always seen in my grandmother's house, but never really asked about, and I'd never really known who they were. Well, a couple of years ago, I was having a conversation with my mother when she mentioned that my grandmother's brother, whose nickname was Bobby, had gone off to fight in the Second World War. And what followed on that discovery was that it wasn't just Bobby, but it was all of the young men of my family, of that generation, who had gone off to serve in the colonial Indian Army and had fought in World War II in different parts of the world. And this was quite a revelation to me. And by following their trajectory through the World War, I managed to uncover this landscape of the Indian experience of World War II.
Why do you think the country and families like yours either forgot about this or didn't talk about it or just neglected it?
I think that in order to forget or to set aside a piece of history that is as large as India's involvement in World War II, there had to be a couple of reasons. And I think Britain and India both had separate reasons for doing so. In the decades since World War II, Britain has cherished this image of itself as the brave little island that stood up alone to global fascism. And that's the image that kind of beams out of a movie like Dunkirk. And what that image does is that it redeems the prior history of Britain.
Mm.
it's been an inconvenient fact that as they fought fascism in the name of freedom, Britain was itself dominating hundreds of societies around the world. And in India, when we think about those years, particularly the early 1940s, what we want to think about is a country that's unified in fighting against the British Empire, because that was the peak of India's freedom movement. So we want to think of an India that was unified in fighting against the British Empire. And it's difficult to remember that so many Indians, especially the army, were fighting for the British Empire at exactly the same time.
So these are really important details for Indians and Indian moviegoers. What do you say to people, though, who say, it's just a movie and can't be expected to teach history? I think film directors would say, we've only got 120 minutes. We can't be expected to provide the audience with every historical detail.
My personal reaction is that the idea of making a film about Dunkirk is boring. It's been done before. It replays a script about Britain in the war that we've heard 100 times. Why are all of the movies that we see about events like Dunkirk? And how come none of them are about this much larger, still glamorous, still heroic history in which Indians and other forces did play such a significant role? A movie that's very close to my heart for that reason is The English Patient, because it's about the Italian campaign. And it's one of the few novels and one of the few movies that has a memorable character who's an Indian soldier in the Second World War. When you look at the World War through the eyes of an Indian soldier, the globe sort of turns and you discover all these new continents, all these new campaigns that aren't part of the popular history of World War II. And many of them are quite marvelous and well worth exploring.
Raghu Karnad, author of Farthest Field, An Indian Story of the Second World War. Dunkirk even got caught up in the Brexit debate when Brexit cheerleader Nigel Farage recently urged kids to see the movie for a lesson in British self-reliance. What that self-reliance is supposed to mean now under Brexit is still unclear. It's been more than a year since the UK voted to leave the European Union, and the aftershocks are still being felt and will continue to reverberate, especially for the 3 million EU citizens living in Britain. The World's Leo Hornack spoke with one couple in Colchester who are on the Brexit fault line.
What's your dog's name again?
Evie.
Hello, Evie.
Frankly, I'm not really a dog person. But even I can see that when you're going through a weird time, having a dopey puppy like Evie in the house is a help.
In many respects, she's sort of kept us sane. You know, you have to take the dog out. You rejoice over the strange things she does.
That's Mary Louise Reed. She and her husband, Jeff, have been married for 32 years. She's a teacher. He's a vicar. Their cosy house, filled with photos of their kids and Evie the dog, is on the outskirts of the English town of Colchester. But on the night of the Brexit vote, something changed for them.
I think we were just in tears. The first sort of putting things into words was, I am who I am now, and that Europeanness has been taken away from me now.
Mary Louise is German and Jeff is English. Their two daughters were raised in both Britain and Germany. And so the idea that Britain would reject what it means to be part of Europe is kind of personal. In fact, on the night of the referendum, their younger daughter, a dual national, was a volunteer at a voting centre. It's still kind of raw.
The day of the referendum, she was dropped off at the place where they were doing this.
How did she feel about that? A dual national counting the referendum votes?
Well, I picked her up at 3 o'clock in the morning, and she got into the car in tears, because this poor girl just saw pile upon pile of leave papers just pile up in front of her.
There's a practical impact too. Mary Louise is one of the 3 million, the approximately 3 million EU citizens living here in Britain. Under EU rules, she's been free to make a life here. No visas, no work permits, no nothing. But now, things aren't that simple for her and Jeff.
We have big questions about actually where we can live, because we're not actually sure in which country we have a future.
After the vote, everyone thought that the 3 million would keep all the same rights they currently enjoy. But the government hesitated. And then Prime Minister Theresa May came up with a proposal. Europeans who had arrived in Britain recently, in the last few years, would have to live under new rules, she said. Settling down here for them would get a lot more difficult.
I think she's very clever at presenting a summary of something that is very complicated. And it was presented as, oh, here's the UK government putting something on the table.
Officially, the proposal's aimed at recent migrants. You might think it wouldn't affect someone like Mary Louise, someone who married a Church of England vicar in the 80s and who's lived in Britain for more than a decade. Well, no. You see, the Reeds have worked abroad. Jeff preached to British expats in Germany and Switzerland, and they only came back to England recently, in 2013. She's a recent migrant.
And in my case, people are not interested in a 32-year-old marriage and the fact that I actually left the country because of my British husband's work. But that's of no interest.
To be clear, Mary Louise is not likely to be thrown out of her cottage in Colchester. But if the couple wanted to spend some time caring for her elderly mother in Germany, for example, it's not clear how it would affect their status. Healthcare is another big question mark. And the current proposal may change with further negotiations. It's pretty daunting for everyone.
For me, it's like having toothache 24/7. You're always thinking of it. There's always something around.
Before I leave, the Reeds show me their home. There's a pair of old photos in a single frame in the kitchen. They're two separate studio portraits, one of a glamorous-looking English woman in the 50s, the other of a glamorous-looking German woman, also in the 50s.
What are you showing me? This is beautiful.
Who are not far apart in age.
The two women met when Jeff and Mary Louise got married. They got on.
When you look at photos of both families, people wearing the same sort of clothes. What separates people? That's what I want to know. Once they get to know one another, what does separate them? And that was the basis of the decision to link economies in such a way. And I think that there's a lot wrong with the European Union. There's a lot that needs to be reformed. But then we've got a 32-year marriage and we are working at it daily, weekly, monthly as well.
It seems like you almost see what happened last year as somehow a kind of insult to your marriage.
I think we feel that as a couple. Here is a country that has turned their back, not just in the EU, but on individuals as well. That's felt acutely.
For The World, I'm Leo Hornack, Colchester, England.
Just enough time now for a quick note from our sports desk. The hometown soccer team in Paris, Paris Saint-Germain, or PSG, has the motto, Rêvons plus grand, dream bigger. And when PSG happens to be owned by Qatari Sports Investment, a fund backed by the oil riches of Qatar, well, you can dream really big. Heck, you can spend $250 million on just one player.
The player is Neymar. He is considered one of the best in the world, for sure. He is a Brazilian player, plays for the Brazil national team, and people might remember him from the last World Cup.
That's the world soccer guy, William Troop. He says PSG is getting ready to pay Neymar's current club, Barcelona, a record fee to secure Neymar's talents. And that's led to accusations of financial wrongdoing.
European soccer authorities have set up this rule called financial fair play. And it is supposed to keep the richest owners of soccer teams from spending their way to titles year in and year out without giving the competition a fair chance.
But there's a loophole. Big spending clubs like PSG are given about 3 years to balance out what they spend versus what they make from ticket sales, TV rights, transferring other players out, and so on, which means those big spenders rarely get fined for breaking the rule. If Neymar's transfer to PSG goes through, the Qatari owners are hoping he'll help them win the biggest club competition in Europe, the Champions League. So for the back office of PSG, the best team money can buy is still their goal. Nothing has changed for the better in Venezuela since we last told you about the crisis there. Today, the company that provided the voting system used in last Sunday's elections said the turnout figure for the vote was exaggerated by election officials. Venezuelan opposition leaders had immediately questioned the turnout figures provided by the government. The opposition also says Sunday's vote for a new constituent assembly is really a step toward dictatorship. One of those who protested the vote was Antonio Ledezma. He's a former mayor of Caracas who was arrested by the government in 2015 on charges of plotting a coup against President Nicolas Maduro. He was later confined to his home under house arrest. But after Sunday's vote, he was arrested again. His daughter, Antonieta Ledezma, told the BBC her father was dragged from his bed on Monday night.
At 12:45 in the night, The political police of Nicolás Maduro knocked at our apartment door. And as soon as my father opened the door, they just pushed him out of the apartment, took him violently in a very abrupt way without any warrant for his arrest. And they just disappeared him. We didn't know whether my father was being tortured, whether if he was being alive. And it was an hour and a half ago that we just finally know where my father is.
And he's been sent to a prison, is that right?
To a military prison with Leopoldo López, the other political prisoner. But as family and his lawyers, we want to know my father's physical condition, because the video that showed the way they took him is terrifying. We know he was beaten, and I demand the dictator Nicolás Maduro to give our family any sort of explanation of the reason of why this happened, of why my father was taken so violently. My father is the only mayor of a capital in the world who's arbitrarily detained. This is something that is extremely unfair, and this shouldn't be happening anywhere in the world.
That was Antonieta Ledezma, the daughter of jailed Venezuelan opposition leader Antonio Ledezma, the former mayor of Caracas. She was speaking there with her colleagues at the BBC. Finally today, there's a video that caught our attention this week. It was filmed by Benjamin Ramirez. He's an immigrant from Mexico who has a food cart in L.A. In the video, a man approaches Ramirez saying his push cart is blocking the sidewalk. Saul Gonzalez of KCRW in Santa Monica picks it up from there.
These two have had apparently past confrontations over the street vendor blocking the sidewalk. This gentleman, who's from Argentina, comes up to him, and the words quickly escalate to the guy turning over the street vendor's push cart.
So there's been really strong reaction to this video in L.A. and beyond. And I guess to really understand the reaction, we need to understand first the climate of these Los Angeles street vendors, these food cart operators, are operating in. Tell us about that.
Well, first off, Marco, I mean, street vending is part of, you know, the city's DNA when it comes to life on the streets. I mean, you see these vendors all over the city, particularly in heavily Latino or Hispanic neighborhoods. But, you know, technically, what they're doing is not legal. The city has still not drafted a formal ordinance to legalize this kind of activity. And that's kind of the background for this whole thing and this whole conversation here in Los Angeles, where these street vendors are kind of in this regulatory gray zone.
Right. So street vending in Los Angeles is not legal, but it was also decriminalized this year, right?
It was decriminalized because of fears of Donald Trump. The thinking going that, you know, you're out there selling your grilled corn or your shaved ice. The cops come up to you. They not only write a citation, but they take you in, they arrest you. And before you know it, you could be expelled. If you're here in the country illegally, you can be sent back to Mexico or Guatemala or El Salvador. So the city stepped in and said, no, we're not going to consider this a criminal act anymore. It's more akin to, you know, earning a parking violation now, and they have to pay some small fine, if even that. But the street vendors, though, still aren't really formally legalized in terms of their economic activity. And that's what the city is still wrestling with. You know, where should street vending happen? How many street vendors should be on a particular block? All of that.
Tell us what's happened, Saul, since the video came out last week.
Well, Mr. Ramirez has become a folk hero in recent days. This guy has been catapulted to an only in L.A. kind of fame, Marco. They've, you know, made T-shirts and hats to honor him. He's appeared on Spanish language television and radio. And he's had the great honor of having music written about him. You know, there's this traditional kind of Mexican folk music called a corrido, which honors significant events and significant people. And he's had more than a couple written about him. Here's one. It's called El Elotero, or the Corn Grill Seller.
Well, the songwriters didn't waste any time honoring Mr. Ramirez. Got to remember, too, that there was this crowdfunding campaign to repair his food cart. So a lot of love for Benjamin Ramirez. Now, in the video, there's also this moment where Ramirez, who's Mexican, calls the man who flipped over his cart racist. And the man responds, "I'm not a racist, I'm Argentinian." And that interaction has also gotten a lot of attention. Tell us about that.
Well, when I first heard about it, I thought, oh, no, this is probably another example of a racist act, you know, some white guy getting in the face of a Latino vendor. But it wasn't, you know, that way at all. It was another immigrant arguing with another immigrant, which, you know, you shouldn't be surprised, I guess, here in Los Angeles. And that's generated a lot of conversation about kind of class issues within the Hispanic community and also just, you know, how gentrification knows no racial bounds. I mean, some people have more money than others in this city. Some of them are immigrants as well. And this is just a very good example of that.
You know, you began by saying this is such an LA story. It really is. It's a fight between immigrants, a sanctuary city taking the side of the angels. And then there are food carts and corridos and basically a happy ending just the way Hollywood likes it.
Yeah, and it really captures a certain moment in the city, Marco, where we're having this conversation, this national conversation, but also local one about immigration, gentrification, the place of immigrants in our society, and the underground economy, right? I mean, Mr. Ramirez is out there hustling for a living, and what should we do for people like him who are in the country, who are not part of the formal economy, and what's the, you know, what is it that the U.S. and what is it that the city of Los Angeles should do to create a path to success for these folks?
Saul Gonzalez, KCRW in Santa Monica, thanks very much. Good to speak with you.
Thanks, Marco.
From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.